of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Stephen R. Jensen presiding, is now in session.
You may be seated. The first case before the court is James Brueggemann versus Jennifer Ramos. Stephen Weslink is here on behalf of the appellant, Ms. Ramos. And Drew Shodall is here on behalf of the appellee, James Brueggemann. Each side will have 20 minutes to present your initial arguments, and then Mr. Weslink, you'll have a 10-minute rebuttal. You'll get a two-minute warning, a yellow light will come on, you'll have 2 minutes left for your argument when that yellow light comes on. So with that, Mr. Weslink, you may proceed with your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Stephen Weslick. I'm here on behalf of Jennifer Ramos, the respondent in the temporary protective order that became a permanent protective order. Jim Brueggemann, now 76-year-old veteran, and Jennifer Ramos have not had any contact since the entry of that permanent order of protection on March 17, 2020, prior to which time they were in relationship since Jennifer was a child. Theirs was not a traditional family relationship, but they considered themselves family nonetheless. They combined their financial resources starting in 2007. At various times, they served as caregivers for each other, and as Jim became older and more frail, Jennifer tended to his needs on a daily basis, managed his properties, and made financial decisions for him, all with his knowledge and consent. This is important to note because Jim would otherwise be alone in this world. It was his intent, in fact, to provide financial support, including a home on Union Street in Belfouche for Jennifer and her children while he was alive, and that she would inherit his estate upon his passing. This was accomplished by the estate planning that was done by then attorney Michael Day in 2012. Jim was adamant, as many seniors are, that he did not want to be placed in a long-term care facility, and Jennifer honored those wishes. That required the purchase of a larger home with no stairs, which was accomplished in April 2018 with Jim's full knowledge, consent, and direction to Wells Fargo Bank to make available to her whatever she needs. And the bank did that. His medical progress notes from the VA do not indicate any diagnosis of vascular dementia until 2011. Jim lived independently until about 2015, and he did not become mostly dependent on Jennifer until 2018. Even at this point, he was able to engage substantially in activities of daily living. Jennifer was faced with the challenge of Jim telling her that he wanted to remain independent and that he would not last more than 3 months if he were placed in long-term care away from his adoptive family, that being her and her children. And conversely, her suggesting to the VA and requesting help from the VA for more care in-home and having to tell Jim that she was becoming more restricted or limited in what she could offer by her own constraints. Her acquisition of her home on Willow Creek was done with the intent to satisfy the VA's demands for a higher level of care, being closer together under the same roof, so that the VA would not act on its threat to terminate in-home care services and leave her stranded. The orders that are the subject of this appeal changed all that. This action, having been brought by Black Hills Advocate, the court-appointed guardian and conservator for Jim, was initiated to prevent contact between the two, require termination of Jennifer's handling of affairs, and return first title to the Willow Creek property, and subsequently almost $300,000, sua sponte by Judge Comer in May. This drastic action took place over the course of only 38 days. That is to the date of the first order in April.
Counsel, on review, the court has to determine what are the fact findings here and what are the questions that we would review de novo. Can you focus more specifically on first, what are the fact questions here that we would review and what, if any, of those findings made by the court? Or, in your view, clearly
We had several components of our brief, starting with I had a focus on abuse of discretion, and then we had the clearly erroneous findings. If I may address the abuse of discretion first, that issue presented in our brief was that Judge Comer did not have testimony from Mr. Brugman and did not have an independent competency examination or hearing to determine his competency to testify. That's the first issue, and we think it's the linchpin of this case and this appeal, that he did not testify and there was no independent determination that he could not testify. There was a, perhaps, but there was definitely in that proceeding a request by Ms. McNally for Mr. Brugman to testify or for the court to determine in some manner that he was able to testify. That appeared in the record at 5286, page 9 and 10 of the transcript from the March 17th hearing. That was discussed by counsel, by the court, and by Ms. McNally, and the court, instead of doing any of those things that were required by the legal authority we've cited, simply said that she had already determined that he was incompetent in the Guardian proceeding and that there was another report that showed that he could not testify because of lack of understanding. But there was no reference even in that testimony, in that transcript, of what the court reviewed. We still don't know what the court relied upon. The record is void of any references to those records. There was no medical testimony from any experts, mental health or medical experts, just like in the cases that we've cited, Lufkins and Warren. There was testimony from medical experts or the witness himself. None of that was done. And in this record that I've just referred Your Honor to, you can see that's the sum and substance of what she did. If we go to the clearly erroneous, I have several findings of fact that we have noted in my own notes as clearly erroneous, but we've group those together in issues in our brief, that Mr. Brugman was the victim of exploitation and neglect in the context of cognitive condition. We think that with an Exhibit 1 of 4,777 pages dumped on the court on Ms. McNally at a hearing within 38 days from the filing of the petition for protection order, that in there is a lot of information from the VA on the medical condition of Mr. Brugman and his cognitive condition. We pointed quite a bit of that out in our brief on the contradictory, contrary, and different findings by different healthcare professionals. Obviously, my opposing counsel has cited to the record to show he lacked capacity. We've cited in our record, in our brief, to the record where there were findings by the professionals, that he had moments where he was lucid or doing well or able to understand things. Those are in our brief. And so we think when you take the totality of all of those decisions, those progress notes, those records by mental health professionals and doctors, it's just abundantly clear that the court did not go down far enough in this record because there was not enough time. Part of our concern in this case is the accelerated process within which these rights by Ms. Ramos were determined in comparison with Mr. Brugman's, when we feel like there should have been more of a process and procedural safeguards. Another question to answer your question, Your Honor, another answer is that in our brief, we talked about the financial fraud and the financial exploitation in the context of the reference from the civil statute to the criminal statute, which requires a finding of fraud, at least by looking at the pattern jury instructions for a criminal case upon which Judge Comer relied in her conclusions of law. When you look at the financial exploitation part of this, we really believe that there was a bad decision here, in the sense that there was a longstanding relationship and pattern of mutual and economic support going back many, many years. In the context of this presentation or case, it goes back to 2007. They had a lifelong relationship, more or less, when it comes to Ms. Ramos. She knew Mr. Brugman since she was a child.
If I could interrupt you, I'm sorry, forgive me. But the conduct that, as I understand it, gave rise to this petition and ultimately this order didn't relate to conduct that had taken place historically over a period of time. Wasn't it more focused on the more recent events, the effort to have Mr. Brueggemann declared not competent, the effort to by your client to obtain money from the investment account and another cash account? So I'm trying to figure out, I understand the context, and I appreciate your efforts to provide us with that. I'm trying to figure out how that figures into these more recent events, because it doesn't seem like the order was issued because of a long history. It seems more recent, but maybe I'm missing it.
Justice Salter, I'm with you on this. I'm confused by the proceedings and the record and the findings and conclusions myself. Because on the one hand, I believe it should be a narrow view, what happened in 2018, right around that time period. But when we go back to the finding of fact of the dementia in 2011, and what I'm reading into the record, again, correctly, I was not part of the underlying proceedings, but did the court make a decision that in 2012 he lacked capacity to purchase that house for Ms. Ramos and her children, where he liquidated some securities at $75,000, obtained a mortgage, and she made the payment? She gave up that home in 2012 to move into the Willow Creek home. And in this order, in a period of 38 days, Black Hills Advocate has taken possession of the Union Street home, which was her previous home, that was clearly intended for her to reside in. Now, I do agree that we need to focus on 2018 for the purpose of competency or capacity. But the outcome here is that she's rendered homeless if she has to get rid of this or reconvey or sell and pay back the money from Willow Creek, because she doesn't have that home on Union Street, and there is no question in my mind from this record, from those proceedings, that he had capacity in 2012. There's no question, there's no dispute even. So while your question is taken well, and I understand what you're trying to get from me, I agree it should be focused on 2012, but I've gone back in time because I think the outcome of this decision, or the case, the decision or the order from Judge Comer, really, really affects fundamental rights, and going back in time, her right to have a residence. She was, after all, the object of his bounty. In 2012, with attorney Michael Day, he made a will for her to receive his inheritance when he passed away. That would have included the Union Street property, possibly the Willow Creek property, and any other assets that he might have had at the time of his passing. We do not know his condition today. It's been over a year. We don't know if he's alive. We don't know where he's living. We don't know his condition. We don't know anything. So I am supposing in my presentation that he's alive, that he hasn't passed. But we don't know that. And it seems to me to be very important to look at the pattern of the mutual economic support. Not only did he provide economic support for her, but she provided economic support for him. In the record, there's references to her making repairs to the properties, which became rental properties, that she put in time, labor, and expense, and she covered other expenses. They intermingled their income and assets as if they were a family, as if she were caring for an elderly father. And so that contribution of that home, I'm using the term for Union Street as a contribution, leaving the home, moving her family, moving into Willow Creek, and now she's been made the villain to say that she got this home and she didn't give anything for it. I think those are important. We understand.
Can I interrupt again? I'm
please, sorry. Yes.
Is the relief you're seeking, because is it an all or nothing proposition? Because there, as you know, there this was a long list of specific items of relief that the circuit court judge ordered. And I hear what you're saying. You're saying that there are some elements of it that, you know, maybe could leave her homeless or particularly objectionable. But as I read your brief, it seems like it's an all or nothing proposition. In other words, you're not saying, look, even if we lose on the findings part, we think that this relief is, for one reason or another, not justified. I don't see that. I see we either win outright and the relief goes away, or we don't. Does that seem right?
I believe that's a fair assessment of our position, Your Honor. Yes. And this is a difficult case for. Don't take for granted that this is not a difficult case for me to present to the court. These facts are really difficult. And I'm representing a client, and I believe that there is an element of justice that can be considered or reconsidered in the case of the decision from Judge Comer. But I understand how difficult this is. I understand at the first reading of this, it looks really, really bad. But we believe that it's important, and it was important for Judge Comer to take more time in this process to be able to get to those facts, to get to the details in those records, to have appropriate testimony, to have Mr. Brueggemann either testify or determine within her responsibility, Judge Comer, I mean, her responsibility to determine whether he could testify. And she failed in that. There was nothing in these progress reports that said he could not testify on the same standards as are presented in Lufkins and Warren. As in those cases, those trial courts did, with the witnesses or medical experts. The ability to know the difference between the truth and a lie. The ability to have a memory and recall facts. And even if there is some diminished capacity at some level, what can be done to safeguard the witness to be sure that that testimony is accurate or prepared and provided in an appropriate manner? Capacity is fluid. It's not static. It is not an on-off situation. He could be lucid in one moment and incapacitated in another. And in these progress notes from the VA, he was being evaluated by some mental health or medical professional, and on his worst days, he was taken to the hospital or the VA on bad days. What was his condition when he was at home? What were those conversations with Jennifer about what was going to happen for her to leave a house that had stairs, Union Street, to a house that didn't on Willow Creek to provide an opportunity for him to live under the same roof? We also know that capacity or lack of capacity can be temporary, situational, treatable, and even reversible. And I believe that this record is insufficient to support, and I believe to support the decision of Justice Comer, and in that respect, I think it was clearly erroneous. We also believe that it was clearly erroneous for Judge Comer to make the decision that he was neglected because he wasn't placed in long-term care. I'm quite certain that some of you or all of you might have cared for elderly parents. I have. As an elder law attorney, I hear clients all the time who say, I don't want to go into a nursing home. I want to die at home. That reality becomes very difficult when the need for the level of care increases beyond what the individual family member can provide. But she did honor his wishes. She didn't neglect him or refuse Meals on Wheels because she wanted to starve him. She said, I didn't accept it because we didn't need it. And we have records that show from the progress notes and as late as January and April of 2019 that he said to someone at the VA, Jennifer takes good care of me. And he wasn't getting good care at Serenity Corners. And that Jennifer wanted to make him happy, wanted him to be happy. She was exercising her discretion to try to honor his wishes, and she was caught in between these forces of the VA and other Wells Fargo Bank, maybe the police chief who was inquiring about, well, he's in Las Vegas or he's about to go to Las Vegas. You have the power to restrain him. By what power does she have the right to restrain him? She was an agent under a power of attorney. That can be rescinded. There's more that has to happen than just being an agent under a power of attorney. But that was a clearly erroneous decision, we think, by the court, in view of the totality of the testimony, especially the testimony and the records. But I think the biggest point that we want to make is his statement in 2018, in April, Justice Salter, he told Troy Niehaus, whatever she needs, make it available to her in the context of purchasing the Willow Creek home. Whatever she needs, make it available to her. He was not kept in the dark. She did not do this secretively. She has not ever denied that she withdrew funds. I dispute the statement and the hyperbole in my opposing counsel's brief that she admitted, self-admitted to embezzlement. That shows up nowhere in the record, but she's never tried to hide the relationship and the financial mutual support between the two of them, and that she was simply trying to take care.
How do you, so the banker's testimony, though in addition to that initial meeting, then referred to later he would get these calls from Mr. Brueggemann asking about the balance and expressing concern and mentioning that he didn't appear he was ever going to get to live in that house. So we have to take that testimony into account as well, don't we?
We have to balance that.
So how do you resolve that?
I respond to it by saying, what did he do in June and July? He didn't do anything. What did he do in April? He followed Jim's directions. What did he do in June and July when he received those phone calls? There's no notes from his records. There's no reports. There's no memoranda or emails. They didn't do anything then. When did they do something? It was later, August and September. And if we have an individual who appeared very lucid in April, provide to her whatever she needs, and then 4 months later can't necessarily stand up to that same standard or comfort with what he's doing, there might be an explanation. It's not in the record, but he didn't do anything in June and July. He said that on the stand.
Time is up, Mr. Winslow.
Thank you.
Mr. Shortall, you may proceed with your argument.
Chief Justice Jensen, Justices of the Supreme Court, Counsel, Law Clerks, may it please the Court. My name is Drew Shortall, and I practice in Spearfish, South Dakota with the Lynn Jackson, Schultz & LeBrun Law Firm. My colleague, Cassidy Stolle, and I represent Black Hills Advocate as the substitute petitioner for Mr. James Brueggemann. In late 2015, the South Dakota Elder Abuse Task Force submitted its final report and recommendations. Notably, Chief Justice Gilbertson was heavily involved in this process. He appointed 7 members of that task force, including the chair of that task force, which was the late Justice Stephen Zinter. Among other things, the task force recommended the passage of legislation to provide a streamlined civil remedy for elder abuse, neglect, and financial exploitation. That was subsequently passed into law in the 2016 legislative session and codified in Chapter 21-65, which is the statute under which Mr. Brueggemann brought his cause of action in this case. To summarize this case, we have Mr. Brueggemann, who is an elderly veteran with severe neurocognitive impairment, who had a long and complex relationship with Ms. Jennifer Ramos. I call their relationship complex because at times it does seem as if they were relationally close, while at other times, such as when Ms. Ramos accused Mr. Brueggemann of raping her when she was 14, and then later filed a protection order against Mr. Brueggemann, their relationship was strained, to say the least. But what is known about their relationship is that as Mr. Brueggemann's mental capacity declined, he came to rely on Ms. Ramos as his primary caregiver and as his agent under his financial and medical durable powers of attorney. Ms. Ramos abused Mr. Brueggemann's trust. She used her power and authority for her own benefit. Ms. Ramos neglected Mr. Brueggemann and financially exploited him. And the reason I bring up how these statutes came to be is because I believe this case is a case of first impression under those statutes that were passed in 2016. And I want to show the court that this is the case. This is just the type of case, just the type of situation, just the type of set of facts that those statutes were designed to protect against. While it's our position that Ms. Ramos's appeal has little merit, it is positive that this appeal has been brought so that this court is given an opportunity to see those statutes in action and to provide case law on those recently enacted statutes.
So, counsel, because we only have a limited amount of time, can you zero in and address your co-counsel's remarks as to why this is a rather unique or different case given the long-standing relationship in the financial transactions that occurred over the years before this particular protection order was brought? How do we reconcile that, and how does that play into whether the court's findings here were clearly erroneous?
Justice Devaney, I think that this situation is not all that unique. I would say that although they weren't family, Elder abuse cases often look a lot like this, where there is a close relationship. Trust is established over many years. Things are going well for a period of time. Not every case is exactly like Ms. Ramos and Mr. Brueggemann, but there's this relationship that's established over a term of years. And in every elder abuse case, or most elder abuse cases, I would say, you could point to a time where it seemed like the elderly person who's being abused showed that they trusted and relied on their abuser. I wouldn't say the facts of this case are all that unique at all.
And maybe that wasn't, you're right. I mean, I don't know that is the case. Maybe situations like that occur. But here, do you think there was a definitive point in time where it then moved into what was a consensual agreement as far as how the finances were used to where it was now moved into the financial exploitation?
I would say it's hard to find an exact point in time where the financial exploitation really began. The record is full of admissions by Ms. Ramos that she commingled their funds, that she'd essentially, what she would say is what mine is his and what his is mine. The one problem with that is she really didn't have much, and she was really relying on everything that he had to provide for her and to provide for her family. I do want to note, though, and I know the court is aware of this, that we're not attempting to retry this on appeal, that really we're looking at Judge Comer's decision and seeing if there really are any reasonable facts that she could have relied on to make her decision. I would argue that there's more than sufficient evidence to support her findings of fact. This court has a long record of giving deference to the trial court as the finder of fact, and I'd ask that the court continue to do that in this case. I would, Justice Devaney. We're reviewing Judge Comer's decision to quash the subpoena on abuse of discretion standard. So we're looking to see if Judge Comer's decision was reasonable. And so what was Judge Comer presented with? There was no, it may have been you, Justice Devaney, there was no argument at the lower level that we should have a separate competency hearing, that we should even that we should call the physicians into court to testify. None of that was raised. There was brief argument from counsel saying, I'm summarizing, we'd really like to have Mr. Brueggemann here because we feel like he would say he wanted Jennifer to have everything and he'd be okay with what's going on.
But well, there wouldn't be any reason to have him there if you weren't competent, right? So doesn't the fact that the Ms. Ramos's trial counsel was asking and seeking this testimony by way of subpoena strongly suggests that she believed that the witness could be competent under Rule 601. I mean, just isn't by virtue of the fact that she's asking for this and saying he could be helpful, isn't that kind of another way of saying we think he's competent to testify?
I'm not sure. That could be. It could be the trial counsel thought that if they could just have Mr. Brueggemann come into court and say, I want Jennifer to have whatever she wants, that would influence the court. I'm not sure what the motives were in requesting that.
Is there a different kind of competency for Rule 601, witness competency versus competency to make your decisions for yourself unilaterally? And if so, can you help explain what difference you might see there?
I may need to ask you to rephrase that, Justice Alford. I'm sorry.
I kind of trail off. So is there a different kind of competency for witness competency? 601, you can testify, people are presumed to be competent. Is that competency different than competency to manage your own affairs?
So again, I don't believe that was raised at the lower level, and I'm not sure that it was in the brief, so I don't know that I'm fully prepared to answer that, the distinction between the competencies, the types of competency. What I would say is that Judge Comer relied on two different physicians' reports that Mr. Brueggemann lacked mental capacity. Those notes are full of things that he was unable to understand complex decisions. He wasn't able to manage his finances. The physicians also noted that it would be harmful for him to come to a hearing. Also, another thing that Judge Comer had before is there is an exception in these elder abuse statutes where the court in its discretion can limit the protected person's exposure to their abuser. That's a specific subsection of the statute. So those were all things weighing into her decision as to whether or not he should appear before her.
Well, we start with the basic rule that everybody's presumed competent. So we've got a subpoena in this case to a witness. In this case, it's a witness that appears to have relevant information and that he's a petitioner and certainly is involved in a lot of these transactions that are being contested. So we've got a person with relevant knowledge. We've got a subpoena. It's kind of an extraordinary remedy, isn't it, to say, yeah, they're not going to testify because they're not competent. And to make that judgment without having that witness in front of you and making an assessment to say, yeah, this person doesn't have the adequate recall, memory, can't tell the difference between a truth and a lie, you know, those types of things that are asked sometimes of children in cases. I mean, this is a pretty extraordinary remedy, and the notion that, well, it was waived and wasn't adequately raised at trial, the subpoena raised it. And then it's on the trial court to say, you know, there's the presumption of competence. Yeah, that there's no competence here. And how did the court reach that assessment in this case, in your view?
Reaching the assessment that he lacked competency to testify? Well, I would say that she based her decision on the physician's notes that not only was he not competent, but that he should not appear and that it would be detrimental to his health to appear at a hearing.
There was a suggestion, I think, maybe that the judge attempt to get on the phone with Mr. Brueggemann. Am I correct about that?
That may be in the record, Chief Justice. That may have been raised by trial counsel for the first time in front of Judge Comer at the hearing. That may be correct.
And that wasn't, you know, what the ultimate result of that was? I mean, did Judge Comer say no, or just there was no indication either way?
You know, I don't recall what her response was. I would like to reframe this discussion, just remind the court that we are looking at this with an abuse of discretion standard. And the way that Judge Comer handled it, we're really seeing if she clearly erred in that decision. Again, one other thing that was mentioned in her oral findings, that this happened in March of 2020, and what was being asked was to bring an elderly individual out of an assisted living facility, bring him to Deadwood, and have him testify in court. And I'm sure all of you recall March 2020, she mentioned some hesitancy in even doing that. So she had, I would say, we have the waiver argument that I think is helpful, but then there's also layers of all these reasons that Judge Comer could point to show that her decision was reasonable, it's well thought out in quashing that subpoena. There's also procedural issues with the subpoena itself. We submitted a brief in our motion to quash that noted that there were some issues with that subpoena. I believe this is a Butte County matter, but it was being heard in Deadwood. And I'm sorry if this is inaccurate, but I believe that the subpoena actually required Mr. Brueggemann to appear at the Butte County Courthouse. And so there was some issues with the subpoena just on its face as well. Adding that to all the other reasons that Judge Comer had to base her decision on.
Aside from Mr. Brueggemann appearing himself, are there any impediments discussed or raised with regard to bringing the doctors in?
There was no request by trial counsel for Ramos to bring the physicians in. So Judge Comer didn't have an opportunity to weigh that or to that was raised for the first time on appeal, Justice Devaney. Just to make sure I understand your question, we're talking about Chapter 2246.1.1, which is an exception to neglect, where, in my understanding, this exception is for well-meaning caregivers who are honoring, just as Mr. Westlick said, this is a common thing for people who practice in elder law. As elderly individuals are losing independence, they express desires not to be placed into a long-term care facility. And so that is an exception to protect well-meaning caregivers who honor those wishes and don't put them into a facility. I would say that is not the case that's before this court, and that's not the case that was presented to the trial court. Ms. Ramos, by her own testimony and by admissions she made to the VA and to other individuals, admitted that the reason she didn't place Mr. Brueggemann into a long-term care facility is because of the financial harm that would come to her, because she had come to rely on Mr. Brueggemann's finances to provide for her own family. What I would say is if this exception is extended to apply to the facts of this case, that exception would basically render all of our elder abuse statutes meaningless. The exception would swallow the rule in that any caregiver who has an elderly individual who has expressed a desire to remain independent, which I would say is the norm, all of their actions are then excused. In this case, her actions, I would say, are pretty egregious. She, at the Union Street house, she had Mr. Brueggemann living in a garage that was converted into an apartment. We've called it a shack in our brief, and I wish there were a picture of it in the record, because I believe shack is an appropriate word. He was living in there with a baby monitor. That was Ms. Brueggemann's version of 24/7 care. That was her solution to moving him into a long-term care facility, which would financially drain her. That's how I'd respond to that exception, Justice Devane.
You think it doesn't apply in this case because that wasn't the true reason why she didn't?
That's correct. By her own admission, on direct testimony. I'd like to take some of my remaining time and just fill in some more details about the Willow Creek home purchase. Excuse me. From your questions, Justices, I can tell that you've reviewed the briefs and the record. But in March 2018, Ms. Ramos began the process of purchasing a home on Willow Creek Road in Belfouche, South Dakota, she and her husband. That initial offer was based on a financing contingency, meaning obviously she had to get a loan to make the purchase. The following week, she contacted Wells Fargo and requested to be added as a supplemental account owner to Mr. Brueggemann's accounts. At the protection order hearing, Mr. Brueggemann's financial advisor, Troy Niehaus, testified. And he asked to meet with Mr. Brueggemann because of the seriousness of adding someone as a supplemental owner to a brokerage account. So they arranged the meeting. Mr. Brueggemann, Mr. Niehaus, and Ms. Ramos came along as well. The financial advisor stressed that at that meeting, he said, this money is only to be used for Mr. Brueggemann's benefit. And Niehaus's testimony was he understood that this money was being withdrawn so that a home could be purchased for Mr. Brueggemann that Ms. Ramos could then live in with her family and she could help care for him. He was not aware that this money was being taken so that a home could be deeded into her name alone. There were other things that Ms. Ramos didn't share with Mr. Niehaus at that meeting. She didn't share that it had been recommended that he receive 24/7 care. She didn't share that he had a severe neurocognitive impairment, and she's very familiar with his medical history. She knew that he was prone to making rash decisions, having a hard time understanding complex financial decisions. She knew that he didn't really understand likely what this meant, adding her to this account. So because Niehaus had a limited amount of information, he added her to that account. Ms. Ramos then changed her offer from a financing contingency to a cash sale. The sellers of the Willow Creek home requested proof of funds. They wanted to know that she really did have the cash and that these funds really could be used to purchase this home and placed into her name alone. She had a problem then because she only had $228,000 in the Wells Fargo account and she needed to make up the rest. The house is about $300,000. So she went to Pioneer Bank. Now to withdraw those funds, she had to rely on her authority under a durable financial power of attorney. And she needed to show that Mr. Brueggemann was not competent. So, and this is Ms. Ramos's testimony, she contacted the VA and said, I need to have Jim, Mr. Brueggemann, declared incompetent. I need a letter saying he's incompetent. So this notion that she didn't know that he was incompetent, she was unaware of this, how could she have known that he was vulnerable? She knew to get access to his funds, she needed to have him declared incompetent. So the VA responded and did another psych eval. Again, severe neurocognitive impairment, inability to understand complex decisions, inability to manage his finances. She took that letter, took it to Pioneer Bank, withdrew another $100,000, used that cash, closed on the home, deeded into her name alone. A few months later, Mr. Brueggemann was in an assisted living facility, and Ms. Ramos and her family were in the home and continued to live in there. And I would say, Justices, this is a clear case of financial exploitation.
So you could leave neglect out of it. Just focus on exploitation theory. Rely upon the clear error deference. And That's why you win?
I think that alone is sufficient. The neglect and the financial exploitation are obviously co-mingled, if you will, because she made financial decisions that were neglectful to him for her own benefit as well, Justice.
What impact, if any, does the fact that she's the sole beneficiary of his will have on these determinations?
Justice Kern, I would say very little. He needs that money now. It may be true that whatever he has left when he passes away goes to her, but he needs to pay for his care. And it's very expensive, as justices surely know, that he needs this money to provide for his care during his lifetime. I would say it's not relevant, Justice. In closing, justices, I would say that this is just the type of case that these statutes, again, were designed to protect against, this type of behavior. Ms. Ramos, I think it's clear from the record that Mr. Brueggemann was a vulnerable adult. I believe it's clear, or there's more than sufficient evidence that Judge Comer had to rely upon to find that he was neglected and to find that he was financially exploited. If there are no other questions, I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Westlink, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. One thing that I would like to dispute that Mr. Shodall just said, and that was that her testimony, and I would take that to also include the record, was that the decision not to place Jim in long-term care was based, and I would insert solely, because I think that's what Mr. Shodall meant, was based solely on preserving her financial position. That is clearly not the case. That is clearly not the case. I can't go through the whole transcript and find particular testimony on that, but I can go to the record. On page 10 of the record, which is an exhibit 2 to the protection order petition, the health care provider at VA said, Jen then stated that she is not going to place the veteran as he is adamant that he will not go into a nursing home and has been, quote unquote, blowing up about it since it was discussed. There's further comments by that note taker or provider that does address the financial side of it, but it's not solely, that decision was not solely based on preserving her financial position. It was always first and foremost about honoring Mr. Brueggemann's wishes as discussed with her, expressed to her at such times as he was able to communicate those things. Mr. Shodall mentioned as well that this statute originated in 2016 as Senate Bill 54. It was a Chief Justice bill. At the time that it was presented to the legislature and the Judiciary Committee, there were concerns expressed by the legislators about the unintended consequences of this bill. I'm not going to go into detail. There's far too little time. But they expressed concern. During Chief Justice Gilbertson's testimony, he stated, there is no such thing as accidental abuse. It has to be intentional abuse. And so I think people of goodwill have nothing to fear from this bill. Now, that's not controlling, but I think it's helpful. Another legislator said, we should monitor this law, and where it needs to be retooled, we need to retool it. Here's the problem that I have with how this whole process has unfolded. Haven't we really circumvented traditional actions and remedies for fraud, self-dealing, breach of fiduciary duty, conversion, even criminal actions for the same subject matter issues or actions? All of those actions, when litigated, require adherence to a procedural safeguards. For example, trial by jury of your peers, discovery, examination and cross-examination of all necessary witnesses, sufficient time to prepare a defense. This case was rushed. It was handled in a haphazard manner, i.e., 4,777 pages, Exhibit 1. It was based on a shallow examination of salient facts, one-day trial, no testimony of medical experts, no testimony of the central witness. It resulted in a loss of contact by Ms. Ramos with a family member, the potential loss of her home, and now a judgment of $300,000, which would render her homeless because she no longer has the Union Street property, and now faces a de facto forfeiture action in a process that took 38 days. And when the
I understand your argument, but is it better directed at the legislature? As you just pointed out a few moments ago, there was an idea that, like many laws, the legislature may from time to time choose to make adjustments or calibrations or wholesale repeal, whatever it wants to do, to laws that is previously enacted. And so, as we see here today, however, the law says what it says and allows the remedies that it allows, and allows as a freestanding action and a freestanding request for relief the kind of protection order and the kind of relief that we have in this case. So I understand your argument, but it doesn't have to be tempered with the fact that the law seems to contemplate this kind of an action and this kind of relief, which is why I asked earlier about whether you are, have a severability argument concerning any of the types of relief. Isn't this what the law allows?
Yes. It doesn't make it right. But yes, that's what this statute allows.
Thank you. Yeah. I understand. Go ahead.
On your part, your argument that this was too rushed of a process and not enough information was brought before the court. We have the issue of the quashing of Mr. Brueggemann's subpoena. Other than that, did the court take any action that precluded Ms. Ramos from putting on any other evidence, calling the actual VA doctors, doing anything of that sort? Is there any reason why that couldn't have been done within the framework of this proceeding?
That's hard to say, since I wasn't there.
Well, and so we look at the court. You know, right now we're reviewing what did the court do. Is there anything else that, besides the quashing of Mr. Brueggemann's subpoena, that would have precluded every VA doctor that examined her to come and testify?
There's nothing in the record that says she asked for that. But what appears abundantly clear to me is that it was scheduled for a one-day hearing. As a trial lawyer, I know I can only call so many witnesses. I know how overwhelming a proposition or a case or a challenge can be when we have constraints and time limitations put on us by the court because of the court's own schedule. And I believe that that one-day time trial period is baked into this statute, this accelerated, fast-track summary proceeding resulting in a forfeiture. And so, no, I can't stand here and say that she couldn't have called more witnesses or asked for more time. But the first hearing was scheduled 13 days after the protection order was granted, or my client was served with it, I should say. Then it was extended for a little bit more time. I think they were scrambling to do the best they could with being dumped with these records and trying to prepare. And there was an inadequate time to prepare. So I just don't think Ms. McNally had the opportunity to fully evaluate those issues, as she would have been, or any trial lawyer would have been, in a traditional cause of action to seek the same outcome, which is kind of what we asked for at the hearing in May. Your Honor, instead of ordering for a judgment of $300,000 rather than the conveyance of the title, let's have a separate legal action. And she did just what Justice Salter suggested, and that was, I don't need to do that. It's in this statute. And I think it's the prerogative of this court to review the actions of the legislature to see if that's proper. And so in the context of the decision by the court, I feel like it was incumbent on the trial court, to have taken more time and examine these with these enormous consequences at stake. And I just think it's fundamentally unfair. And I think we're going down a wrong path here in South Dakota with this type of process in place, and in particular the way this court followed it in the errors that we pointed out in our brief. I'll take any remaining questions, but at that point I would just thank you for giving us the opportunity to have this argument with you.
Thank you. Thank you for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to the court. We'll be in recess for 10 minutes.